My name is Barbara, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hello.
I have a sobriety date, which is August 14th of 2010. I have a sponsor. Her name is Elise, and the Midtown Group in Bethesda, Maryland is my home group. We meet on Sunday nights. Also, if you guys are ever in the Bethesda area, please let us know. Come visit us. It's a great speaker meeting, and it saved my life. I've been going there since I got sober. It is really an honor to be here. Thank you so much, Sam, for asking. I actually came to this meeting probably 5 years ago with my first sponsor, and I remember her speaking here. And I know that my sponsor thinks very highly of this group and what you guys do here. So thank you very much for having me. So I'm going to tell you in a general way what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now as a result of working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I prayed before the meeting and asked God to give me the words and to be honest. So I'm not sure what will come out, but hopefully it will be the truth. So I, like a lot of people talk about from the very beginning, I was uncomfortable. I was restless, irritable, and discontent, like it talks about in the book. I didn't know how to make friends. I didn't know how to talk to people. I just always would look at other people and wonder why it looked so much easier for them, you know, than it felt for me. And I was always comparing my insides to other people's outsides, which is still something that I struggle with today. I remember being in kindergarten and being like, someone would be like, what's your favorite color? And I would be like, well, what's yours? And they'd say blue, and I'd say that mine's blue. You know, like just always trying to be a chameleon to fit in. Like I never had, really until I got sober, I never had my own opinions. I never had my own ideas. I didn't know what I believed in, you know. And my parents certainly taught me right from wrong. But like as far as like interests and likes and dislikes, like I really didn't know what those were. Like I was whatever you wanted me to be, you know. And from a very young age, I was obsessed with what you thought of me, you know, and that obsession definitely, you know, drinking worked really well for that. And really, like, that obsession paralleled my alcoholism in a lot of ways, you know, getting attention from people, getting validation from people, having people like me, being popular, all of that stuff. So, I was a crazy kid. I had really curly hair and braces, and I wore like biker shorts that were like to my knees with like everything all the time, and I didn't fit in well. I did not dress cool. I did not act cool. I had so much energy, and I didn't know what to do with it, and I would run around, and I would like lick people on the arm and run away, or I would just like run up to you and scream in your face, you know, and it's like, well, no wonder you're having trouble making friends, you know, but that's just how I behaved. Like, I just didn't know how to be cool. I still don't. I have zero chill. Like, I'm not a smooth person. I'm in sales today, and I regularly ask myself how I ended up in sales, because I can be so awkward, you know? So I was like that from the very beginning, and really, like, I'm certainly not alcoholic because of my upbringing. My dad is alcoholic, and he got sober, before I was born, my parents gave me, you know, everything I needed and most of what I wanted, you know, and I grew up in McLean, Virginia, in a nice area, and I played sports, and, you know, they involved me in a lot of stuff, and no one ever told me that I was bad, that I was wrong, that I should be ashamed, but I felt that from the very beginning, and I cannot tell you why I felt that, but I did, you know, and I just always felt ashamed of myself, and I remember like being in therapy as a kid and all of that kind of stuff. And I remember I started the first time I took a drink, I was 14, and I got sober at 18. So my drinking career was short, but it was just jam packed of great stuff. So the first time I took a drink, I had actually, you know, I was in high school, I was a freshman in high school, and I had finally met a group of people that were like cool, and we would like go after school and like we would go smoke like Black and Miles and stuff, and I didn't even like it, but I was doing it because, you know, I mean, I never had any like I'm never going to drink. I didn't have reservations like that, or whatever. Like, I basically was willing to do anything that you thought was cool so that you could think that I was cool. And definitely a sellout. And so the first time I drank, I remember we stole, like, everyone collectively, like, stole beer from their parents', you know, basements or whatever, and we all got together on a teacher work day weekend, and everyone got drunk, and I was drinking Corona, and I hated the taste, and so I didn't end up getting drunk, but I saw everyone around me get drunk, and there was this guy who I liked who got, like, blackout drunk and was, like, chasing me around the house, and I, like, had to hide in the bathroom, and then finally when I could come out, my friend was, like, passed out on a mattress in, like, a pool of vomit, and, like, I looked at that situation, and I was like, I'm doing this wrong. She looks like she's free, you know? And I don't think that that is a normal interpretation of this situation. Like, I feel like if I was normal, I would look at this and be like, this was weird. This was really dramatic. Like, this is crazy. I don't want to do this again. But I looked at it and I was like, I've just done it wrong. I just did it the wrong, you know, I just did things wrong here. So, you know, so I proceeded to, you know, try and get drunk the following weekend and discovered vodka, which was my favorite. Like, whatever does it, I'm not someone who really likes the taste of alcohol. And so whatever does it the quickest, really. And so I'm all about cheap plastic bottles of vodka. And, you know, and really whatever's free, whatever's, whatever I can get without, you know, you finding out. I'm not a bar drinker. I am a basement and forest drinker. You know, I've never been to a club. I got sober before it was even legal for me to drink, and for good reason. But, you know, I remember this next time that I drank, I blacked out pretty much immediately. All I remember is, like, trying to pee in the woods and just peeing all over myself. And I woke up the next day and I was like, that was awesome, you know? And I remember thinking, like, I realized this feeling of, like, release that I had never felt before in my life, you know? Like, just the next morning, like, no consequences, didn't get in trouble, like, I didn't care what you thought of me, all of this stuff. And I remember thinking, like, this is how other people must feel all of the time, you know? And, like, I could just breathe. And I remember a speaker once saying that that alcohol set her free. And I feel like it did for me, too. You know, that was my experience. The voices in my head that would never stop, you know? Just the self-centeredness, you know, selfishness and self-centeredness, which it talks about in the book, like, it, you know, it was eating me away, and alcohol almost kept me sane, you know, for a period of time, and so, anyway, I started, you know, once I drank like that and knew what alcohol could do for me, I sought it out as much as I could and as often as I could, and, you know, I was in high school, and, like, I had interests, I had, you know, I was in theater, I loved it, I was a good student, I never wanted to get in trouble, like, I was such a goody-two-shoes, and, like, all of that, you know, just, like, willingly gave it away to drink, you know, I just didn't care about that stuff anymore, because what drinking did for me, it was more than any of these other extracurricular activities, you know, and really, you know, it was like this double-edged sword, because I really, like, I never wanted to be a bad daughter, like, I always wanted to make my parents proud, I wanted to be a good friend, I wanted to be successful in school, all of this stuff, but, like, when it came to that and drinking, I just didn't have a choice. You know, like, I would always choose drinking over that, no matter what, no matter, I mean, I could take a lie detector test saying that I wasn't going to drink that night, and, like, and I would, you know, and it's, like, the curious mental twist that we talk about, and that's the thing for me today is that I know I will always return to drinking. All I have today is a daily reprieve. Like, I am definitely still alcoholic, and I feel like the longer I stay sober, I find that out more. You know, that drinking is very much not my problem. Alcoholism is my problem, you know, and I've learned that into sobriety. And so, and I'll just say, too, that, you know, I got sober young, and I started going to meetings when I was 16 or so, and I just thought that an alcoholic was, you know, someone who had lost everything, who had lost a marriage, who had lost their kids, you know, who was, like, homeless, drinking under a bridge out of a paper bag, you know, and I just thought, well, that's not me, you know, and I didn't relate in meetings, and I wasn't ready to be sober, and I wasn't desperate enough to hear anything, but I definitely didn't relate, and I didn't think alcoholism or any kind of drug addiction was my problem. I just thought, you know, I just thought there was something else wrong with me, and they just hadn't figured out the right medication for my kind of crazy. And I thought, I do too many drugs to be an alcoholic, which is, you know, when I finally got sober at 18, I took all of the drugs out of the equation, and I found that for me, once I take a drink, I don't know what's going to happen. And that's not about the circumstance, it's about how much I'm going to drink once I take a drink. And I have no guarantee. As soon as I ingest alcohol, I might have two drinks and go home, which has happened like two times, right? And like when I first got sober, I was like, this is why I'm not alcoholic, because this one time I had two beers and then I went to sleep, you know? And it's like, but what about the rest of the times? And that's my problem, is that maybe sometimes I can control my drinking, but there's no guarantee, you know? And there were many, many more times where I said, you know, that I was going to drink a certain amount, that I promised friends I would only drink a certain amount, and then I would always overshoot the mark, you know, or I would come up with some reason, some excuse as to why it was okay for me, you know, it was going to be different this time, you know, like that was definitely my MO, was like, oh, this time's going to be different, and here's why, this time's going to be different, and here's why, you know, because I forget, you know, I'm unable to bring into my consciousness, like, the memory of the suffering of even a week or a month ago, like it talks about in the book. I mean, that's me, like, I can't, you know, it's like, I wake up in the morning, and I have the four horsemen, and I feel awful and terrible, and I promise myself that I'm never going to do this again, that I'm going to, you know, I'm going to go to school, I'm going to get to all my classes today, like, I'm going to be nice to my mom, you know, all of this stuff, and then a few hours later, and I'm like, I can't even remember why, you know, was it really that bad, you know, like, I can't even remember why I promised myself that, or if I can remember how bad it was, I can't take it. You know, I mean, that's just like being sober without a solution for me. I mean, I want to rip my skin off, really. It's unbearable. And I did a lot of like, so I remember like my drinking, I was around other people who were drinking young and being crazy, and that's all we cared about. And I thought that it was normal. And then things started to happen where people started questioning, my friends started questioning my drinking, and I was sneaking out every night. My parents actually at one point put an alarm just on my bedroom door so that I couldn't leave. And I couldn't leave my room at night. And because I was like permanently grounded. So I would never leave the house after school. Like, it's like this thing where I was like, I didn't want to break the rules, but like I had to. So I like just didn't want my parents knowing that I was breaking the rules. Like, I still cared so much about what they thought. And I remember this one time I was at my boyfriend's house and he had a fire ladder. And I was like, this is the perfect solution. This is exactly what I need. And so I took the fire ladder home, and then, you know, I told my dad that I was going to bed, and then I just like threw it out the window and like climbed out of my bedroom window on this fire ladder. And it was like 5 feet off the ground. I don't know how I got back up, you know? And I remember like telling my friends that night, and they were like, you know, and I was like, isn't this so crazy? Like, I got them, you know, I fooled them. Like, I'm so sneaky. And they were like, what's wrong with you? Why would you do that? That's so dangerous. You know, like, that was this clear point of like, okay, well, maybe you just don't tell people things like that. Like, they just don't get it. It's not as hard for them. Their parents let them do whatever they want. So of course they wouldn't understand. You know, these are the things that I would tell myself. And my parents just continued to be like more and more and more terrified. And it's interesting because, you know, I remember thinking like, you know, if you would just leave me alone and let me do my thing, we'd be fine. Like, if you would stop grounding me, if you would stop taking stuff away, if you would just give me money like I asked, then we would be fine. Just let me do my thing. And meanwhile, like, my parents aren't sleeping. They have no friends, you know, because they feel like they can't talk to anyone about what's going on with their daughter. You know, and that's what I do, is I steal peace of mind, which, being a parent today, I don't even have a glimpse of what they went through, you know, but like just even imagining that is like so painful. But I have no idea. And that's the thing, is that I want to care about you, but I can't, you know, it's just not there. And really, like, I don't even think before I started drinking, I had the ability really to care about other people. Like, I wanted to, and I knew the right things to say. But I didn't really, like, it wasn't really there, you know, because I always felt like there was this wall between me and the rest of the world. Like, I never felt like I had a true partnership with another human being. So I started freaking out my parents. I mean, I would come home high, drunk all the time. You know, I remember this one time they started getting me drug tested, and I like swallowed a couple bottles of Robitussin and was like, because it's funny because I hated that stuff, but it was like, it was my only choice, and so I did it anyway, you know, because I had to have something in my system. And I remember, like, we sat down and they turned on Armageddon, and I was like, I have to get out of here, you know. But I, like, couldn't leave, really. Like, I couldn't move my body normally, so I just started, like, walking like a robot almost, and, like, and laughing to myself as I was doing this. And, like, my parents were, like, totally freaked out, and I was, like, you know, chuckling or whatever. And I feel like that's something that we think is funny today, but my parents did not think it was funny. And actually, like, my mom didn't leave the side of my bed all night because she thought that I was going to stop breathing, you know. And that's, and I'm like, you know, and me at that time, I was like, you're so dramatic, you know. And, like, I could just no idea or no care or concern for what I was putting the people in my life through. And so, you know, I'm trying to think. I mean, I didn't even, I remember, like, I would wake up in the morning and I would, like, look myself in the mirror. I had gotten to this point where I was, like, really trying to, like, give myself the pep talks, like, you're going to go to school, you're going to make it through the entire day. You know, like, you don't need this stuff, like, you can stay sober today. And I would leave the house and I would buy first period. Sometimes I wouldn't even make it to first period and I would have to turn around, you know, and I'd have to get drunk. You know, I couldn't even make it, like, a couple of hours into class. And I honestly didn't even know, like, I didn't know what withdrawal was. I didn't know, any of this stuff. And, I just kept thinking, like, I'm going to get it together just, like, tomorrow, you know? And I had no life, you know. I mean, at the end, like, all I was doing was I didn't have any friends. My friends had stopped talking to me by this point. And all I would do was I did a lot of Sudoku, in my closet. And I took a lot of selfies. And so selfies are, like, a big thing today. But, like, back then, I, like, had this camera, and I would, like, get dressed up, and I would, like, put the camera on self-timer and then, like, go into, like, areas of my room and, like, pose, you know, or I'd go on the patio and pose. And then I would, like, upload these pictures of myself to an album and, like, edit them and post them on Facebook. And it was, like, what I did with most of my time. I was so obsessed with what people thought of me, you know. And I think about today, too. I was, like, 14, walking down the side of the road, no shoes on, which I can't tell you why. I really desperately wanted to be a hippie. And so I would, like, walk miles without my shoes on, which I don't think that qualifies you to be a hippie, you know. And if anything, it's just, like, really unhygienic. It's probably dangerous. And it's, like, I'm, like, this kid in the middle of the night walking down the side of the road, like, and I was, like, I'll be safe because every time a car passes, I'll just make a really ugly face. And then that way they won't want to kidnap me, you know. And that was, like, my tools for life at the time. And by the time I was 16, my parents finally, I got really sick. I was so thin because I was never eating because it would, like, I wouldn't be able to get drunk or high enough if I would eat. So I just, like, never ate. I didn't really care. And so I got sick and I was so sick. I had the flu. And I remember, I had finally gone back to school after, like, a week, and I got drunk and I passed out in the bathroom, and I just blacked out. I had taken a bunch of stuff, and I woke up, in a bowl of spaghetti at home, and, like, I just remember, like, lifting my head and being like, what's happening? Where am I? And my parents did not know what to do with me, and so they took me to the psych ward. And actually, while I was there, I remember my dad came to visit, and I gave him a hug, and I grabbed, he had, like, his pills on him. So one of the things that was, like, hard for me in sobriety, my dad took a lot of pain medication because he had a surgery that went wrong, you know, and so we had this really sick relationship where I would steal things or I would ask him, you know, for his pain medication when I couldn't find anything else. And he would take that and would still claim to be sober and tell me how I needed to be in AA and do these things. And anyway, I'll get to that later. But so anyway, he came to visit in the psych ward, and I stole his pill, like, I don't know, holder out of his pocket and got high in the psych ward. They called Child Protective Services on my parents, you know, my parents had to be monitored for a year. And I had it's like I just had no idea, you know. I mean, I knew when that happened, I was like, well, this is pretty bad. But, like, being a parent, I cannot even imagine having CPU. Like, I mean, that's some rough stuff, you know, and that's just what I put the people in my life through without any care, you know. And so after that happened, they were like, you're going to rehab. And so I did, and that was the first of many rehabs and outpatients and all of that stuff. I mean, my parents spent, you know, they had saved up money for me to go to college, and they spent it all on rehab because they said, we don't know if you're going to be allowed to make it to college. And, you know, and they were just desperately trying to save my life, and I was so, I just couldn't stand being around them, you know. I thought they were so annoying. And so I started going in and out of rehabs and, like, you know, and I was someone who I would go and I would, I didn't, you know, I just thought, like, this is going to fix me. You know, every time I would go, I'd be like, I just need, like, 30 days clean, whatever, and then I'll get out and I'll know how to drink like a normal person. Like, this teaches you how to drink like a normal person. And that was, of course, never the case because alcoholism is progressive. And every time I would get out, things would get worse. And you know, and I would go to meetings and everything, and I could, like, talk the talk and make it sound really good, but, like, every time I would get out of rehab, it would be the same thing. I mean, the first time I got out of rehab, you know, I remember, like, getting home, and finally, and I was so excited, and I was like, now I'm fixed, and I got home, and, like, the reality of, like, this is it now, you know, sunk in, and I just sat in my room and dug my nails into the carpet because I could not stand the way that I felt when I was sober, you know, because I had not discovered AA, nor was I interested in AA at that time, and I didn't know what to do with myself. Like, what do you do now? I mean, how do you just sit here? What am I supposed to, you know, like, what am I supposed to do with my life? And then across the hallway was my parents' room, and I went in there, and I started trying to steal stuff, and I found my dad's pills, and I stuck them down my pants, and my mom came and found me, and she made me strip down naked and counted all of the pills one by one, and she asked, do we need to take you back, you know? And that was the first time where, like, I honestly knew that I did not have an answer, you know? I could not tell you why I was doing that, you know? And I really didn't know. And because I really thought, like, I was like, this is going to fix me, you know? And then I wasn't fixed. And so I could make up an excuse as to why I was doing that. Like, oh, I just feel crazy or, oh, you know, whatever. But the reality was, like, I didn't know any more than you did, like, why I could not stay sober. And so anyway, I proceeded to do, like, a ton of different rehabs and outpatients, like I said, and really, you know, I remember at the end, I was seeing this outpatient counselor who actually was a member of AA, and she was amazing, and she never pushed anything on me, but, like, when the time was right, she finally suggested that I go back to rehab, you know, and I really didn't want to. I felt like, I've done this, I don't need it. I was like, I just need to go to one of those rehabs where they put you to sleep for a week and then you wake up and you're fine, you know? And, like, I remember, I don't think they exist, but I was, like, sure of it. And so I remember calling, like, places, and I talked to this doctor, and he was like, no, that's not real. And I was like, yes, it is. I've heard of it. I'm sure he was like, what the hell's wrong with this girl? You know, but I was like, I just want you to put me to sleep for a week and then I'll wake up and I'll be fine. And he was like, that's not a real thing. We don't do that here. I don't think anyone does that, you know? And just always, like, I mean, Alcoholics Anonymous was definitely the last stop on the block for me. You know, like, I would ask for, try anything. And, you know, and I remember, like, throughout, like, getting out in and out of rehab and trying to, like, I would, like, go to meetings half-heartedly and, like, maybe get a sponsor by name, and I'd be like, I just need to get a dog, you know, or I just need to get a new car, or I just need a boyfriend. I'm going to change my clothes. I'm going to get really into astrology, and then I'll understand myself better, you know. And, like, it's true that self-knowledge avails us nothing, especially not astrology, but, like, I understood by the time, like, I got sober, I had a pretty good understanding of alcoholism, or at least, like, I knew that I could not drink safely, and I also knew that, like, I kept doing the same thing over and over again, but, like, that enough is not, you know, like, that alone is not enough to keep me sober, and neither is any circumstance, you know. And and it's funny, like I talked about earlier, I was like, oh, I haven't lost a, you know, a husband or kids or whatever, but it's like I was 18 and drinking so much that, like, I could not accumulate any of that stuff to lose anyway. And the things that I did have to lose, which were my self-respect and dignity, I gave those away a long time ago. You know, those were very, you know, they were long gone. So I was with this outpatient counselor, and she suggested that I go to detox again. And so, begrudgingly I went, and, you know, I wasn't ready to get sober this time. I wasn't willing. I wasn't like, I've had enough, any of that stuff. Like, I just didn't have anywhere else to go. You know, I had nothing left. And, and the other thing that I was going to say is that no circumstance will ever keep me sober. You know, no amount of getting in trouble, no frothy emotional appeal, people yelling, people crying, you know, seeing my family members in pain, like, none of that will ever be. I could know that I would go to jail for the rest of my life and I would drink again. You know, it will never keep me sober. Maybe it'll keep me sober for a day, but not forever. And so, anyway, I ended up going into detox, and really, I feel like it was the first time that I just couldn't pull myself up by my bootstraps one more time. It was the first time that, like, I had a window of willingness where I was like, I actually don't know what to do anymore, you know? Like, I don't know what's wrong with me. I don't know why I keep ending up in the same spot. And so I ended up, I was at a meeting in detox because they brought meetings in. I was at Cat's Detox at Fairfax Inova, and my home group at the time, and I think still is, but they were bringing meetings in there, and someone came up to me. I shared in the meeting. I have no idea what I said. And someone came up to me after the meeting and asked me if I had a sponsor. And I said, no, will you be my sponsor? And I didn't even mean it. You know, like, as soon as I said that, I was like, what have I done? You know, like, oh, my God. And but it just came out of nowhere. And for me, I believe that's a loving higher power. Like, I just that's not me, you know. And so, like, I met the right, I mean, you know, we talk about seconds and inches. Like, I met the right people. The right people were there at the right time, you know. Like, I happened to be in detox on a Tuesday night, which was the only day of the week that they brought that meeting in, where this woman came up to me, you know, and reached her hand out, you know. And both my first sponsor and her sponsor at the time, my sponsor now, were at that meeting, you know. And so when I got out, like, again, I wasn't even really, I wasn't like, okay, it's time for me to be sober. Like, my parents had kicked me out. I had nowhere to go. I ended up moving into someone's house from detox, who was like a guy who was like 30 years my senior. So obviously that didn't work out well. And so he was like, you can live here for free. Just drive me to work because I have a DUI. That's like, things that are too good to be true usually are too good to be true, right? And so I remember I stayed one night there, and I called Jill the next morning, and I said, I need help, you know, and I need to get out of here now. And someone came and picked me up and let me sleep on her couch, this woman and one of her friends. And it's funny because at the time I was like, it never would have occurred to me that maybe someone wouldn't want me to sleep at their house. Hadn't showered in weeks, you know, was like walking around with a duffel bag, didn't have any regular clothes, like, did not pack pajamas, toothbrush to detox, packed heels and skirts, like, just totally delusional. And, like, long feather earrings. I spent, like, hours looking for these earrings. My mom was like, we just need to go. We need to go. Like, stop looking for the earrings since they're gone. And so she, this woman, let me sleep on her couch. And it was my first introduction to what is still today my home group, Midtown. And I had gone to young people's meetings before, but I wasn't ready. And I also had never felt as surrounded as I did at that meeting. And I remember, like, you know, it was just, I was at the right place at the right time. And I went to a Saturday night meeting and a Sunday night meeting, cause I got out of detox on a Friday. And, you know, I just felt like for the first time that I could hear what other people were saying, you know, and I felt like women were talking to me and talking about things that I didn't even know that you could say out loud. You know, I related so much. And it was the first time that I felt like maybe this is what's wrong with me, you know, like, maybe, like, I felt like you guys had what I had, you know, and so I remember, like, going to this meeting, and it was, like, that weekend was the first time that I had felt like hope in the first time ever, maybe, you know, throughout the course of my drinking. Like, I really felt like people were so kind and reached out their hand, and no one let me stand alone for a second, you know, which is something that I try and do today too at a meeting, is like, if I see someone standing by themselves, to go talk to them, because like, there's nothing worse than standing in a meeting by yourself, you know. And so I ended up going into this halfway house, and because I didn't have anywhere to live, and you know, I remember, like, it was like all about going to meetings, and it was sort of like good. They had this structure, like you had to be home in time for dinner, and someone would make dinner, and we had these groups and stuff. And I didn't need any of that stuff, but what I needed was the consistency of the meetings that I was going to, and that happened there, because there was no other way you were allowed to leave the house unless you were going to a meeting. So I had plans with people every single night of the week. I was going to meetings every single night of the week, and I started meeting people, and I started getting excited about AA. And I was working with a sponsor, and I remember, like, I had no idea what was happening. My first step, when we did my first step, she had me make a list of examples of powerlessness and unmanageability. And I just made a list of all of the things that I was powerless over. Like, I didn't understand. I was like, I'm powerless over my parents. I'm powerless over my brother, you know. And she was like, okay, we'll keep moving. And she kept reading with me. And I don't think that I really started to understand. Like, I would sit down with her and we would read the big book, and I felt like I was reading Arabic. Like, I had no idea what was happening or being said in that book, which is why a sponsor is important, and big book meetings too, because I started to understand by people sharing their experience about what was in the big book, what they were trying to say there, you know. But I was also still so, like, my brain was so cloudy. I couldn't finish my sentences, you know. You know, I had this friend who was like, just loved me from the minute she met me. I don't know why. And she would just like bring me and try and introduce me to people. And it was like I was mute. I mean, she'd be like, this is my friend Barbara. She's awesome. Like, she's got, you know, 7 days sober or whatever. And I would just stand there and like stare, you know. And she'd be like, she's really cool. I swear. She talks more than this, you know. Like, because I was just sitting there and I was like, I should say something. You know, just so much self-centeredness, you know, that was all coming forward, because they're like, it wasn't numb anymore. And like, I would just think so hard about how to participate in the conversation that I just couldn't say anything. I loved smoking when I was new because did not know what to do with my hands. You know, do you put them here? Do you put them down here? Do you put them behind your back? Like, what do you do with them? And so I just smoke a million cigarettes all the time. And at 6 months over, I got a car and I started picking people up for meetings and you know, being involved in that. And like, and from the beginning, my sponsor was really involved in fellowship and service, which was really, really good for me when I was new, because I needed to be excited about life. I was 18 years old, you know, like, and I needed to see that we aren't a glum lot. And I would just pick up people, and I would be like, I think that I was so crazy. I would be like, driving, I had a manual car, and so I would like be driving this stick shift car, like people, like just like people stuffed into my car, like drinking a Mountain Dew or like a Red Bull, smoking on the phone, shifting gears, you know. And people would like get out of the car and be like, oh my god, we survived, you know. And I'd be like, that's so rude, you know. I just no idea what's happening. And and I started dating really on into sobriety too, which I don't recommend, but actually, I got really lucky, and he's now my husband. So we've been together since I was 3 months sober and he was 4 months sober. And so we grew in AA together, which was really cool. But my sponsor made it very clear that I had to always put AA first, and always put new women first, and helping other people, and Jeff work, and God first. And so I think that's the only reason why that relationship made it. So I was really involved in fellowship, and service, and I, you know, loved that for a number of years. And, I remember this one time. So, you know, speaking of like not making someone your higher power, well, it was hard to avoid, right? And so my boyfriend was definitely my higher power for a little while there. And I remember this one time he went to jail. No one knew he was going to jail. And he like one day was just called me from jail. And, you know, we were both like a year sober, and I was like, lost my mind, you know. And it was like the first problem that I had had into sobriety. And I remember, like, I was actually driving, and this was like at a time where they were doing road work on 495. And like, I was, someone rear-ended me and I had my phone in my hand and it went up and knocked me in my two front teeth and I like lost my two front teeth. Like it just took a big old chunk out of them and I just started screaming. Like that was all I could do was I just started, it was actually losing my teeth was on my first four step. Like it was like a really strong fear that I had and it happened and I had this poor, my sponsee sister in the car with me and she was like, it's okay, calm down, we have to get his insurance. And I was just like screaming and like called my dad, which is so terrible, you know. He was like, they were like, what's wrong, what's happening? And I was like, I lost my teeth. He was like, can you find them, you know? I was like, no, you don't understand, they're gone, like just totally. And like, and then my parents sent this ambulance because they were like convinced that something was really wrong with me. I wasn't in any pain other than just my ego, you know, and my vanity. And they sent an ambulance and these guys came and checked me out and I was like hysterically crying and then hysterically laughing and they were like, it's okay, we all have fake teeth, you know, it's fine. And I was like, you don't understand, I have to go see my boyfriend in jail tomorrow. And they were like, what, you know, like, why is, or should you be with him? You know, I was like, if you don't understand, it happened a long time ago, you know, like just totally crazy. And so, but that actually was a good lesson for me because it was the first time that, you know, I realized, and I remember telling my roommate at the time, like, I am mad at God for having this happen. Like, so I was so dramatic, but it's funny now, but at the time I was really very upset and I told her that I was mad at God. And she said, and I remember too, my sponsor, I called her and she said, get over yourself. And I was like, just a dagger to the heart, you know? And I remember telling my roommate and she said, well, you know, and she had a lot more time than I did. And she said, well, I don't call my sponsor, you know, to make me feel better. I call her to tell me the truth, you know, and if you think that you have a punishing God, maybe you should take a look at that. And I was like, you know, I kind of put that one on the back burner. And I remember a couple years into sobriety, like I said, I basically sustained on fellowship and service alone. You know, I had done my steps and I had done a fourth step and a fifth step. No idea what 6 and 7 was. I had done some amends, you know, but it wasn't until I got pregnant that like things changed, you know, because once that happens and you have a life circumstance change like that, I was not able to pick up people all the time every night and just be drowning in service and fellowship, you know, and so something had to give. And so I remember like, feeling crazy. And I remember, well, so I'll go back a little bit, which is, you know, so I, for a long time, I would talk in meetings about God and I would say, and I would tell people I sponsor, you know, what God looks like and what an 11 step looks like and all this stuff. But I could tell you that I had no idea, you know, I had never been interested in seeking a higher power. And I didn't until, you know, really one day, actually, I remember sitting outside of a meeting and my friend, one of my friends, said, you know, was talking about this day she had, and she said it was so awful. And she said, well, I'm really grateful that I sat this morning. And I thought, oh, it was like a light bulb went off. I was like, oh, is that real? Like, does that work? You know, like I'm someone who thinks for some reason that rules or suggestions don't apply to me. And like, that's good that you do that, but it's not necessary for me to do that, you know? And I've kind of been that way my whole life. And definitely with the 11 step, I was like, yes, other people definitely need prayer and meditation. I think I'm okay though, you know, I've got this. And, which is a very dangerous thing for me to think. And so, and I remember like living in this sober house and there was this guy and every morning he would sit at this table and meditate. And like the first time I remember walking upstairs and seeing him and just like slowly backing out of the room, you know, cause I was like not sure what was happening there and wasn't interested. And then eventually, and then I would like, sometimes I would just like run past him, you know, and then eventually I asked him like, what are you doing? You know, can you show me? And so me and this guy, Matt, we would sit and we would read. He would show me 86 to 89 and we would read and then we would sit in silence. And I think I could only make it maybe 5 minutes at the beginning, if that. And I felt like he just sat there for like 30 or 40 minutes and I would just get out, you know? But that was like the first introduction that I've had to the 11th step. And really like my experience with the steps is that I did not really, I really did not do any of them very willingly. You know, it was all like, eventually when I was in enough pain, I became willing to do them. And so my first step, I feel like, has changed over the years. And I don't think that I understood what it was until I started talking to other alcoholics. And when I started sharing my story with new people, I started to have a better understanding of like, oh yeah, I drink and this is what happens. This is not normal. You know, like it's not normal to not know what's going to happen when you take a drink. And the God thing, like, you know, I never had any prejudice towards God. I didn't go to church as a kid or anything like that. I didn't have any ideas. I just didn't know what to think about the God thing. Like, it was almost so big, and, like, I just didn't even want to take a look at that, you know. But I did understand that a third step was, like, at the time, it was like, okay, I'm going to do what my sponsor suggests. And I'm going to listen to what other people suggest, and I'm going to do my fourth step. And I was actually excited about doing my fourth step. Like, I hated doing all of the written work because I'm lazy, but I was excited to do it and, like, share it with her, and I felt like it was this big thing, and people talked about it in AA, and so I kind of wanted to, you know, people were always asking, like, people still do ask, have you done your fourth step? Have you done your fourth step? And I wanted to be done with it so I could tell other people that I had finished it. And I was, you know, and I had a good experience doing my fourth step, you know, really, but I didn't have any, like, big secrets because my whole life, like, so, you know, talking about forming true partnerships with other human beings, like, the way that I would try and connect with people during my drinking is I would just tell them something that I was, like, really ashamed of or something bad or crazy that I had done, and I would tell them, and for some reason I would hope that they would be like, I've done that too, and then we would, like, be connected, and I would, like, feel something, and, like, every time people were like, what, you know, maybe you should talk to someone about that, and, like, it never worked, and so this is the first time that someone had all of the information on me, and, but I wasn't really, like, when I was new, like, if I was either mute, or I was, like, not gonna let you talk to me until you heard the full story, like, one of those, and I remember being in the car with someone, she was driving to a meeting, and she, like, was driving with the wheel for a second, and I, like, reached over and, like, grabbed the wheel, and she was like, stop, you know, like, I don't know. So I did my fourth and fifth step, and I sat for the hour. I slept for the hour, let's be real. And I just couldn't wait to get out of there to go see my boyfriend. You know, like, I did not feel like I was walking hand in hand with my creator. In fact, I felt really uncomfortable. And then we read 6 and 7, didn't do anything about that, I really did not understand 6 and 7 until probably, like, 2 years ago into my sobriety, you know, and then I started making amends, and I started making amends to my family and friends, and that was, you know, and I don't have any really, like, amazing, amends stories, but I will tell, you know, a couple of them. But, you know, basically I just checked the boxes, you know, for a while. And a 10th step, I was doing that regularly. And my sponsor had me writing stuff down every night, to bring her every day when I called, which was, like, I think great practice, for me, but I had no idea what really my inventory was either for a while. But I had a 12th step in the way that I was helping people, but I certainly wasn't acting like an AA member outside of AA. So my life circumstances changed. All this stuff happened. And what's really ended up happening for me is, like, the longer that I stay sober, the more that I see that I'm not a nice girl who drank too much, the more that I see alcoholism is alive and well in my mind. And so that's where 6 and 7 comes up, because, like, all of this stuff has come up for me, like, all of these defects of character, like, really painful ones. You know, I thought the longer you stay sober, the less you will do bad things because you'll just be better. Not true. The longer you stay sober, the harder it will be to be honest about things like that, you know, because you don't want to look bad, at least in my experience. And, you know, around 6 years sober, I started doing some really, really shady stuff. And I did not want to be honest about them. And then when I did get honest about them and kept doing it, I didn't want to get honest about it again, you know, and I felt like every time I would, like, begrudgingly tell friends, like, they would judge me, and I felt like my sponsor was judging me, and, you know, and I had, and this was the first time that, like, I really, I, I could see in my life what a seventh step needed to look like, right? Which is to act differently, even if the obsession is still there, and God will remove that, which is my experience, you know? But I remember, you know, it's like, I'm like 7 years sober. I shouldn't be doing this. Like, and I would go to meetings and I would just want to walk right out. You know, I was sponsoring 10 people and, telling them how to live their lives, you know, and I'm like, being just weird and sneaky. But I'm grateful that I was honest, because I feel like, you know, especially like the very last time that like I was honest about what I was doing, it was like, I mean, I could have drank, you know, and it was around the holidays. And man, I like before this period of time in my sobriety, drinking hadn't really bothered me or occurred to me. And maybe it was because I wasn't used to drinking in social situations, but it really started to come up. And I would be very aware of what people were drinking. I was feeling like I was missing out, you know, and it was a really dangerous period of time. And I just started to think, and the other problem is, like, if I'm not being honest about this stuff and trying to do something different, I start to feel like, you don't understand. You can't tell me, you know, like, you don't get it. My case is different. Like, that's, you know, the alcoholic battle cries, like, I'm different and here's why, you know, and this doesn't apply to me and here's why. And I feel like I got honest just one last time and it saved my life, really, because I don't know when the time is going to come where I'm not honest about something and it just takes me too far away from you to get back. And I am a prideful person and I really don't know that if I left AA or if I got too far away that I would be able to make it back, you know, because I care so desperately about what you think of me. And so, that was like this great lesson in, you know, not only identifying character defects, but also like how to be humbled, you know. And it actually was like, became this amazing thing because it was this experience that I could share with the women that I sponsor and other women that I know. And it made me, and it humbled me to this level that I probably hadn't been humbled to before, where I was like, I mean, at least since I was new, you know, because I would talk to these women and I would just think like, just stop doing that, you know, like just get over it. Stop doing that. Stop thinking about it. Like, geez, like, I don't want to hear this again, you know? And like, once this happened, it was like, I understand it's not that simple, you know, like I understand, that acting out like that is like, an obsession. And if I could just stop, if I could just, you know, right the ship and like be, you know, act normal and behave how I'm supposed to, then I would not need the 12 steps. I would not need to be an AA, but that's not how I am. That's not how I'm programmed. You know, I'm still selfish and self-centered to the core. You know, I still seek everything else outside of God before I seek God, you know? So I've had the opportunity to start to live differently, which is really cool. And so I talked about sort of these check the box amends, which were amazing. But really the amends, the biggest, most recent amends that I've made, not the like most recent, but the biggest one was to my little brother. And my little brother, like I actually, the first time I did my eighth step, my sponsor was like, I don't think you need to make amends to him. And then my sponsor now was like, whoa, yes, you do need to make amends to him. And I was like, by this time, you know, 6 years sober. And so it was like, I felt like embarrassed that I still needed to do this and get this done. And I remember like, inviting him, you know, to go out to eat with me. And what I had done to him was I constantly, like, I would pit my parents against each other to him in his mind. I would make my mom out to be, like, the worst person on the face of the planet, and I would talk to him about how cool drinking was and how I couldn't wait for him to be able to drink, and he took medication, and it was, like, these little capsules that you could open, and, like, the stuff would come out, and then you could close them back up, and it would, like, no one would know the wiser, you know, and he took that because he needed it. He was prescribed it by a doctor, and I took it because I'm selfish. And so my brother during this period of time was like crazy, you know, he was up and down and no one could figure out why. And it's because of me, you know, like, I mean, maybe that wasn't all of it, but like, I thought at the time, like, I'm so sneaky, you know, look at me. Like, I was proud of myself, you know? And then I realized like 6 years into sobriety, like, wow, that is his brain chemistry, you know, like that is some serious, like, to mess with that, like, you know, like, that's not fun and games, you know, that's like, I remember when it hit me, and I just felt like, I can't believe that I did that. That's the thing. It's like, drinking didn't make me do that. That is who I am. That is how I operate, you know, without a solution. And I didn't tell him that because he doesn't, you know, need to know that, because he never did. But I did make amends to him, and I remember, like, and I remember all he asked. And I had also pawned all this stuff. I pawned everybody's everything. Like, I just did not care about. And it was, I remember when I first got sober, my mom was, like, looking through her jewelry and realized that all this stuff was missing because I had taken the oldest stuff that she never wore, which was her mom's, who had passed away when she was, like, 10 years old. And I had taken all this stuff to just get, you know, gold to get melted, to get money for, you know, what I needed to do. And so I pawned all my brother's stuff, his games, his, you know, guitar and all of this stuff. And so, you know, anyway, he asked me for the money and I didn't want to give it to him, you know, because at the time, like, he was drinking and doing all that stuff. And I thought, like, no, I don't want to give it to him. Like, it's not, you know, my sponsor directed me to just give him the money. Like, it's not my business what he does with it, you know? And I don't know what he did with it. I think he's like trying to be a musician. So I think he used it towards the recording session or something like that. But man, I remember just feeling like, oh, not wanting to make that financial amends so bad, you know? And that's the thing, is like, I can talk nice, I can make myself look good, but like, you know, how willing am I really, you know, on a daily basis to do this stuff? And sometimes, like, I am not very willing. And I've also had the opportunity to make amends to my dad, which, like, again, it wasn't, I mean, for me, like, I haven't had any, like, really amazing moments. It's really been about the living amends for me. You know, my dad, when I first got sober, I would tell him, he would come to my celebration and he would introduce himself as an alcoholic, and I would tell him, you're not sober, you don't get to say that here, you know. And today, like, that is none of my business. I don't have to say anything to him about that. He still says that he has the same, you know, sobriety date, and like, I congratulate him on his anniversary, you know. Like, that's none of my business. Like, my business is being a daughter, you know, not his sponsor. And really, like, the life that I have today, I was thinking about this earlier, is really beyond my wildest dreams. You know, like, when I first got sober, all I wanted was to be able to put my head on the pillow and fall asleep at night, you know. And I didn't want to be paralyzed with crippling anxiety all of the time, you know, when I was talking to people, when I was looking at people. I mean, I just wanted to feel okay. I wanted to feel like I could breathe, you know. And I have gotten that and so much more. I mean, today I have peace of mind, and I love myself. I have self-respect and dignity. I don't walk around carrying that shame everywhere with me. I have been able to use this stuff to help other people, you know, and I feel like that has set me free. And I know that I am not a bad person trying to get good. I'm a sick person trying to get well, you know. And I have, I have plenty of material things, but really what's the best part about my life is the relationships that I have today. You know, my parents love me. I hated my mom, and oh my God, she is my best friend today. Like, she is my best friend. And, you know, my husband and I have two kids, and we have a sober house, you know, and we live by principle there most of the time. And we have people over, and we sponsor a bunch of people, and it's like, we have them over for step work, and it's like the best thing ever, you know. And the friendships that I have today are ones that I actually care about the people in my life. You know, I care when good things happen, when bad things happen. I care about the people that I sponsor, you know, and I want to help. And for me, like, that is the greatest gift of all, you know. And also, like, being able to help people and watch the light come on is just the greatest gift on earth. I mean, that's what, you know, we're doing here, I think. And I feel privileged to be able to help people in that way, and to help people find God and seek God, and stay, you know, on the path of happy destiny. So I'll just read this one section out of the book, and then I will shut up. So this is at the very end of A Vision for You. It says, abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thanks so much for letting me share.